So, Prabhupada's presentation of Srimad Bhagavatam. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Sapatna Nihato Yudhe Gyatayas Tam Upasata Ushinareshu Bhudraja Suyagya Iti Vishuta Sapatnar nihato yudhe Gyatayastam upasata Ushinareshu Bhudraja Suyagya iti vishuta Sapatnar nihato yudhe Prabhupada's translation, Ushinareshu, in the state known as Ushinara. Abhut, there was Raja, a king, Suyagya, iti das Vishuta, celebrated Sapatnai by enemies. Nihata, killed, Yudhe, in war, Gyataya, the kinsman, Tam, him, Upasata, sat around. Prabhupada's translation, in the state known as Ushinara, there was a celebrated king named Suyagya. When the king was killed in battle by his enemies, his kinsmen sat around the dead body and began to lament the death of their dear friend. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pristaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swamini Dinamine Namaste Sarasate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Visesham Yuvade Paschatya Deshatane. So this story is being narrated by none other than Hiranyakashipu, Gold Pillow. You've heard of Gold Finger. This is Gold Pillow. Or Gold Cushion. It's interesting that we have a story in the Bhagavatam where the worst demon, Hiranyakashipu, is really the one of the worst demons of all time. He's definitely a Hall of Fame demon. So, and he, when we see someone take a certain propensity to its last extreme, we learn, for example, everyone gets angry sometimes, but sometimes we hear about someone or read about someone who became so angry they committed some terrible crime, they killed some. That they kill someone or commit some terrible deed, and then we actually see the limits of anger. Even though most people don't become that angry, still, when you see someone become angry and just go all the way, then any normal person takes a lesson from that and tries to restrain themselves. So Hiranyakashipu went all the way, so to speak. He performed austerities. It's common in this world that someone will perform austerities in order to get certain power. People even do that to make money. We perform certain austerities working hard, whatever, and hope to make some money. Or we perform austerities by, let's say, in school, try to get good grades, try to get a good job to make money. It's the age of capitalism, everything sort of culminates in making money. Or even if you consider someone like that bicycle rider, Lance Armstrong. It's amazing how famous you can become by riding a bicycle. It's a good lesson to all the young people out there. Ride your bike very seriously. Anyway, it took tremendous austerity. People, it's the, let's see, what is it, 2007? Next year is the campaign season, so we will be blessed with all kinds of meaningful, sincere political speeches. And in order to run for office, it requires a tremendous amount of austerity. People that are running for office, major office, like for president, basically don't eat normally, don't sleep normally. They travel more than an ISKCON sannyasi. They travel for months and months. They're almost every day in a different city. It's a wonder that they survive it. So much austerity in order to get power. Now, if you look in Hiranyakashipu, anyway, there's this general principle that if you work hard, if you deny yourself other pleasures, if you really discipline yourself, that you get a certain power. The universe is made in this way. And there are formal austerities where, let's say, a yogi or a sage, through self-abnegation, tries to get a certain power. They also usually get a very bad temper. People never notice someone that has missed a meal. Sometimes they become irritable or hasn't slept enough. And we find this, that actually even the great sages, some of these great sages, because of their austerity, is not eating and sleeping, they actually get a really bad temper, and they sometimes curse people, and so on. Anyway, Hiranyakashipu performed all these austerities. You can't get more austere than that. He fasted so much, for those of you who are like into fasting, he fasted so much that he literally just became a skeleton. And that is serious fasting, if you think about it. He fasted until he just became a skeleton, and he somehow maintained his life air circulating in his bones. Of course, don't try this at home because you could hurt yourself. So he wanted control of the universe. So these were the ultimate austerities for the ultimate political power, ultimate power. He wanted to take over the whole universe, and then, of course, the whole project collapsed at the end when Lord Nrsimhadev killed him. He had the bad luck of having a Hare Krishna son, or the good luck, you would say. Actually, Hiranyakashipu is, of course, I forget whether he's Jai or Vijay. Does anyone remember that detail? He's Jai. Now, what's interesting is that here, this always strikes devotees, Hiranyakashipu is preaching. He's preaching, you're not that body, and don't lament for the body. He's telling a story. He's actually one of the Bhagavatam preachers. The same Hiranyakashipu who is going to try to kill his devotee son, Prahlad, is here preaching. He's giving a Bhagavatam class. And he's preaching detachment, you know you're not that body. So what is this that Hiranyakashipu is preaching? The fact that this is included in the Bhagavatam, the fact that this story is told in the Bhagavatam, this is an example, I believe, of true spirituality as opposed to mere dualism. We, in this world, we're attracted to stories of good versus evil. And when we see stories like that, it gives us a chance to dovetail our hatred. Or, you know, if you see a story and there's a real demon, you get to hate the demon. It's a passionate experience to support the heroes and be against the demons, to rejoice at the destruction of the demons when they're blown up into little pieces and so on. And yet in the Bhagavatam, that passion of good versus evil, friends and enemies, is mitigated by this insight that even the demons are ultimately devotees. Now, all demons, most demons are obviously not pure devotees just playing like demons. They are actually conditioned souls who are trying sincerely to be demons and not just playing like demons. But still, when we hear this story and realize that the greatest demon, I mean, there's several things to learn from Hiranyakashipu. One is that if you are materially ambitious to the last degree, if you try to get power in this world as far as possible within the universe, at the end, you'll still just die. And so if even the ultimate power grab, if the ultimate ambition, the greatest austerities simply lead to death, why bother? So we need to see that example in order to really learn this lesson. If there was just a story where someone performed, let's say, medium austerities and got medium power and then died, you could say, well, maybe the person didn't take it all the way. So there's something about seeing someone do it to the highest degree, the highest possible power of the universe, the greatest austerities, and at the end, it all comes to nothing. That's one unmistakable lesson here. Another lesson is that Hiranyakashipu is ultimately a devotee, and so it just trains us to see even the worst people as ultimately spirit soul. Now, in truly dualistic worldviews, like, for example, traditional Christianity, the bad guys are just the bad guys. And the devil, for example, this interesting notion of a devil who is beyond redemption, the enemy of God forever. It's interesting because if the devil is the enemy of God, who is paying his utility bills? In other words, like, what keeps the lights on for the devil? If you consider Vedanta, Janmadhyasya Jataha, the absolute is that from which everything is coming, then if there's a God who is the source of everything, why does God maintain this bozo wannabe deity, the devil? Now, someone says, well, God allows the devil to stay in business because, you know, competition is good. Or because it weeds out all the people unqualified to go through the pearly gates, and so on. But then if that were the case, the devil would just be doing God's work. And the devil is a living being, or even a fallen angel, isn't it? Lucifer or something. So if the devil is a fallen angel, why not? What about the possibility of the angel someday coming back to the movement? You know, the angel sometime... But there was a Christian philosopher of the Middle Ages named Anselm, and for Christians he is Saint Anselmo, and he put forward the ontological argument for the existence of God. He's trying to prove that God exists, and he said God is that being than whom no greater being can exist. God is that being than whom no greater being can be conceived. The argument is a very tricky argument. So he says, if you say God doesn't exist, I can think of a greater God, namely one that does exist. It's a trick. But philosophically, it's actually hard to defeat. It's, any case, it's one of those arguments that doesn't really convince you, but it's very tricky and hard to refute logically. So, although atheists have been trying for 1,000 years. But in any case, Rupa Goswami actually gives a version of this argument. I don't think Rupa Goswami studied Anselm, but it's the same idea. Anselm is saying that because God is the supreme being, the highest conception of God is the truest. And Rupa Goswami gives the same argument in the Nectar of Devotion, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, where he says that Krishna is the original God, not Narayan, or Shiva, because Krishna has more qualities, because the conception of Krishna is the highest, therefore it's the truest. So this is an interesting argument given by Rupa Goswami, given by the famous, to some people, Christian philosopher Ansel, that the highest conception of God is the truest, because God is infinitely great. Interestingly, what Anselm operated within a monolithic culture. In other words, at the time of the High Middle Ages, when Anselm was doing his business, Europe was basically the kingdom of Christ on earth. That's how they conceived of it. Europe was the kingdom of Christ on earth, Christendom. That was during the late great days of the Crusades, other wonderful adventures. So for Anselm, also, if you think about it, in those days, they weren't really aware of any theistic traditions outside the biblical ones. And so Anselm was trying to prove God exists. Anselm figured, or believed, apparently, that if you prove God exists, it must be the God of the Bible, because there are no other gods. As far as Anselm knew, there were no other candidates. There was only one candidate. So, if God exists, it's the God of the Bible. However, there is another great candidate, and that's Krishna. And Anselm didn't really try to argue that not only does God exist, but the greatest conception of God is the Christian God, or the Christian conception of God. He would actually lose that argument. C.S. Lewis, the guy that, I don't know if you saw that, there was a movie, Narnia. It was sort of a, you know, quote-unquote, a Vaishnava movie. But actually, so he tried to defend certain aspects of Christianity, but the argument I'd like to make, as illustrated by Hiranyakashipu here, is that even if we agree that God exists, if we agree that the highest conception of God is the truest, it's not going to be the Christian conception of God. That's just not going to make it, for very obvious reasons. Because I'll give you a few reasons to show why. I'm not saying that the Christians are not worshiping God, but that conception of God is simply not the highest conception of God. The first reason, I think, is on obvious moral grounds. God has to be not only infinitely beautiful and infinitely wise and strong and rich. He has like an infinite number of credit cards. It's not only that, but God has to be infinitely moral. There's a seventh opulence, which is, I think, not less important, and that is that God has to be a perfect moral being. We discussed this last night. So how could a perfect moral being, or why would a perfect moral being discriminate among souls? For example, if a mother or father treats their children unfairly and unequally, no one would accept that parent as a good parent. If for no good reason a mother or father rewards one child and punishes another, how could anyone accept that parent as a worthy parent? Oh, great soul. Now, because in Christian theology they do not accept reincarnation, at least, mostly because all the Christians that preach that after the time of Christ were either killed or banished. So, not by philosophical persuasion, but by demonic violence, that doctrine was suppressed whenever it popped up in Christian history. So anyway, when you're stuck with that bad philosophy that the souls are just created now, it becomes impossible to explain why some souls are born in horrible conditions and some souls are born in wonderful conditions. It just becomes There's a very large file called Religious Mysteries. Religious Mysteries. Prabhupada said that religion without philosophy becomes sentimentalism or fanaticism. And if you in any way follow the news nowadays, you can see very clearly all the evils of religion without philosophy. Religious fanaticism has become probably the biggest political and social problem in the world right now. But this notion of religion without philosophy actually became formally enshrined as a Christian doctrine. It actually became established as a desirable principle under a philosophy called fideism. We say bona fide. It's one of our pet terms. Bona fide in Latin means good faith. Bona fide, good faith. So fideism, faithism, was a doctrine that stated that God has intentionally made his revelation apparently irrational, because this humbles human beings who tend to be proud of their intelligence and forces them to give up their pride in their intelligence, stop trying to figure things out, stop trying to be rational, and just accept God by faith alone. So this was adopted by certain Christian philosophers who realized that many of the basic claims of Christianity were actually irrational. And so some of them came up with this idea of fideism, which is of course very dangerous, because if you claim that God's revelation is basically irrational, then you can say anything. For example, you can just murder innocent children and say, well, you may find this very hard to believe, but God actually wants me to do this. And if someone says, why, you could say, wrong question. You can't ask why. You're just being a typical arrogant human being who's trying to understand everything rationally. So fideism is, it sounds pious, like, yeah, come on everybody, let's just accept God and not be puffed up, not be proud of our intelligence, this whatever God wants, don't try to figure it out. I mean, it may sound pious and surrendered and all that, but it actually leads to monstrous consequences. Because anyone can say anything. And it eliminates rational discussion, philosophical discussion, as a relevant means of trying to evaluate religious claims, and all you're left with is fanatical, dogmatic screaming, like, this is the truth, that if you don't believe it, you're going to hell, and that's all that's left. Basically, there's no other way to evaluate or to debate religion. It's just, you know, everyone just screams their doctrine. It's not that all Christians accepted fideism, but this was one prominent strand. So a God who just creates everyone like this life is your first life, and people have very different situations. Why? Religious mystery. Or, for example, the idea of torturing people in hell with no intention. With absolutely no intention of correcting them. I mean, imagine a mother or father that punishes their children not to correct them, not to help them, but just because I want you to experience pain, that's all. It's just for the sheer sake of your suffering. There's no other purpose. It's not to help you, it's not to correct you, it's just to make you suffer. As Plato pointed out in one dialogue, this is actually evil. It's actually evil to wish someone pain and suffering, not to help them, not to correct them, but just because you want them to suffer, is a very primitive emotion. How could an infinitely merciful God want people to suffer just so they could suffer? Not to correct them, just so they will suffer. And not only that, but they suffer in the most horrible, excruciating ways, and they suffer like that forever. So, I mean, imagine it's awful. If that conception of God were true, God would actually be a monster. And if we study the history of Europe, for example, and other parts of the world, we can see that this demonic concept, it's actually demonic. It's worse than wrong. It's not merely wrong, it's actually demonic. This demonic concept of God led to all kinds of demonic behavior. Because if God is going to torture people forever, why not serve God and start the process here on earth? Let's start torturing people here. And we're doing, you know, as in heaven, so on earth. So what we're really seeing is there was something, apart from all the piety, and there was real piety and all the devotion, all the very good people and saintly people in that tradition, there was something really evil about this. There was some real poison in this tradition. Just poison, evil. And if you look at the history of it, this particular group of people, and we're not talking about Jesus here, we're talking about a historical religion, we see that literally almost the day after they stopped being persecuted, they began to persecute. So it's not persecution per se that they were against, it's just they wanted to be the persecutors. I mean, we can go into all kinds of historical details and things, but it's not necessary. But what I mean to say is, if the highest conception of God is the truest, this psychotic notion of God. Yeah, I was just in Oxford, and the center of Oxford is a big monument in the old city to these three Oxford theology professors who were burned alive. They were. And this is worse than, you know, Florida's antiquated electric chair. Old Sparky. Three theology professors were burned alive at the stake by Bloody Mary, Queen of England, because they were Protestants and she was a Catholic. So because of some somewhat subtle theological disagreements, she burned them alive. I mean, these acts are not merely wrong, they're evil. These are evil acts. And these are evil acts which were directly justified by appealing to an evil God. So, the notion that God rejects all of his children who sincerely try to approach him or call on him simply because they don't belong to the right religious institution, and tortures them forever if they don't join the right church. These conceptions are not merely wrong, they're evil. And almost psychotic. So, if the greatest conception of God is the truest, this is Rupa Goswami's argument, then it's actually Krishna. Because there actually is a conception of God in which God truly is merciful and is intelligent and rational. For example, as we were discussing yesterday in the Bhagavad Gita, in the seminar yesterday, that if you read the Bhagavad Gita, if you just read it, what you find is that you can be elevated in this world, you can be happy in this world and wise in this world without Krishna. I mean, not literally without Krishna, because Krishna's always there, but without worshipping Krishna. Krishna clearly says in the Bhagavad Gita, as I said last night, urdanga chanti sattvasta, those in standing in goodness go up. This is literally what Krishna says. And if you read the Bhagavad Gita and see all the descriptions of the mode of goodness, it has nothing to do with Krishna. It's just about moral behavior. There's no statement in the Bhagavad Gita which says that in order to be in the mode of goodness, you have to worship Krishna. Does anyone know a verse that says that? So, because Krishna is not a psychotic, I mean, he's not a monster. So as long as you're in this material world, you go up or down, or sideways, depending upon the moral quality of your behavior. It's not about religious dogma. And if you want Krishna, then you have to worship Krishna. Krishna does happen to be the greatest thing there is. Krishna is the most attractive. Krishna is God. And if you want Krishna, you have to worship Krishna. And if you worship something else, you get what you worship. But it's not this psychotic, evil conception that for certain thought crimes, not moral crimes, thought crimes, in other words, you did not believe some eccentric interpretation of the death of Jesus. Because you did, in other words, that's a thought crime. You didn't believe something. It's not about the fact that you kick old ladies in the shins or you steal from the hungry it's not about actual moral crimes against humanity or against other creatures. It's a thought crime. It's a mental crime. So for certain thought crimes, you will be tortured forever. Now, can someone explain to me how this is not demonic or practically psychotic? That for certain thought crimes, you'll be tortured forever. And in the context of eternity, which is a very long time, in terms of saying the punishment fits the crime, in the context of eternity, one lifetime, where, let's say, as a mature adult, maybe you have 20, 30, 40, 50 years, whatever it is, and you don't get it, somehow you commit some thought crime, even though you're morally a good person, and then you're tortured for trillions of trillions of trillions of quadrillions of pentillions of sextillions of septillions of octillions of years. In other words, forever. And why? Because for a few years you were a creep here on the earth and you may have even been a good person, but you committed thought crimes for a few years, so you're tortured forever. This is insanity. It's evil and it's insane. And so and if you contrast that with Krishna consciousness, like again here Hiranyakashipu, There's a reason why this story is there in the Bhagavatam. We have gold cushion. You know, there's gold finger. Gold cushion. And then there's gold eye also, Hiranyaksha. The original capitalists. Keep your eye on the gold. So you have Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu, who are these, you know, cosmic demons, and yet they turn out to be devotees. So it just, I think these stories are there to prevent, first of all, they're there because they happen, but also to prevent us from just falling into hatred, passionate hatred, in the name of religion. So we have this sort of like this safety valve that prevents us from becoming degraded by becoming hateful, passionately hateful creatures in the name of religion, which is exactly what happened in so many other religions. So anyway, that's Rupa Goswami's argument. The highest conception is a truest, and the highest conception is Krishna. So any questions on these points? Yes, ma'am. Not exactly the point. Okay, that'll cost you extra, though. There's a surcharge for, yes.
What is your favorite argument for the existence of God?
My favorite argument for the existence of God. Well, I don't know. I think the most obvious one is the argument from design. Because it's obviously true. It's like a no-brainer. And there are a lot of people, some people have no brain, so. But yeah, it just seems to be obviously true. I mean, there's so many arguments for God, just the nature of reality, not only the complexity of reality, the nature of consciousness itself, the way we exist, as sentient beings, that we're capable of certain kinds of feelings and insights. It seems everything points to God. Yes?
You mentioned how in the Bhagavad Gita it says...
Un momento, por favor.
Maharaj, you mentioned how in the Bhagavad Gita it says that if one is pushing the law of goodness, one can be happy in this material world. So in other parts of the scriptures, Srila Prabhupada says that this is a miserable world, and any idea of happiness is also illusion.
Yes. So Krishna says that in the Gita, Dukkhalaya Mashashvatam. There is an answer. There's always an answer. I also mentioned that in the mode of goodness, one gets knowledge, and the knowledge one gets is that we're not this body. So in the mode of goodness, one moves toward a spiritual conception of life. It's a material position, but there's a sense of a spiritual reality behind the material reality. Krishna describes this in chapter 18, I believe, text. I think it's 18.20.Gita, where Krishna says that in the mode of goodness, knowledge in the mode of goodness is knowledge that there is a single, unperishing reality behind all the temporary reality of this world. So it's not a complete, it's not yet completely on the spiritual platform, but there's that sense. So one's happiness comes from that sense of an unperishing reality. Otherwise, the world is miserable. It definitely is miserable. Neelaji. But you, which voice? Okay.
I like the argument that you gave for the existence of God, but I also I would like you to answer why the qualities mentioned in the Nectar of Devotion make God the greatest and highest.
The qualities mentioned in the Nectar of Devotion?
And also following Rupa Goswami's argument, he says that our conception the conception of God as the greatest is the truest, but that's still our conception, so that gives us the authority of defining what is the greatest. And people have different ideas of what is greatest and how can one know who's greater than the other.
Very good, very clever. Someone please take her out. Can't challenge the Bhagavatam speaker. So, all right, where shall I begin? The Empire Strikes Back. First of all, I would say it is begging the question to say that it is our conception. If the fact that a human being on earth puts forward a certain claim, such as the highest conception of God is the truest, or that 2 and 2 is 4, or 2 and 2 are 4, or whatever it is. The fact that someone puts forward a claim on earth doesn't mean that that is, quote unquote, his or her conception. If I say that objectively, 2 and 2, is it is or are?
Is.
2 and 2 is 4. Okay. Let's go with is here. Many things is hard to figure out in this world. So if we say 2 and 2 is 4, and someone says that's just your conception, by saying that, you have an underlying premise or assumption which we will bring to the surface so we can ridicule it. I mean, the underlying assumption here is that there is no true objectivity on earth. And that whenever anyone claims something to be true, that person is being subjective, and there is no certain knowledge, there is no real objective knowledge in the world. So you would first have to establish that, which of course you couldn't for the following reason, that if you say that no one really knows anything for sure, then what you just said is also not sure. It's like never say never. As soon as you say no one can speak objectively, then you didn't speak objectively. So it's one of those cases where if you're right, you're wrong. So I think actually it's almost logically impossible to show that there's no objectivity. Because if you show it, then what you claim is also not objective, and so it's just like it's nonsense. It's like trying to prove, it's like trying to show a square circle. It's just something which by definition you can't demonstrate. So if there is objectivity in the world, but still, I think just the categorical claim that there's no objectivity in the world it fails as an argument. So the next stage of your argument, I'll try to salvage something from what you said. The next stage would be that, well, how do you know, even if there may be objective ways of evaluating higher and lower qualities, how do you know you have the right scale? Isn't that basically, that's what you said, isn't it?
And how can my authority be the authority?
I don't think it's a question of authority. I think we would say that things are true because they're true, not because, of course, one way of knowing something is true is because it comes from an authority. Like if you're on a plane and they say there's some turbulence up ahead, please fasten your seatbelts, you sort of figure, okay, they know it. So we accept authorities all the time, and hearing from authority may be considered a valid source, possibly, in certain cases, a valid source of knowledge. But in the case of Rupa Goswami, first of all, clearly Rupa Goswami, what he's not doing, he's not arguing against impersonalism. And so therefore, he's addressing people who are worshiping some personal form of God, either Shiva or Krishna or Narayan. So he's addressing theists, in a sense. It's an inter-theistic argument, or intramural sports, whatever. Anyway, so he's addressing that. He's talking to people who are already committed to some form of worship. And he's saying that Krishna just exhibits more qualities. As far as the validity of his criteria, if we look at the kinds of things he points out, I believe the things he points out are almost universally accepted. In other words, almost everybody in the world accepts the value of some kind of music. If someone says all music is evil, that's a very strange mentality, isn't it? Say that all music is evil. So practically everyone accepts that music is, at least good music, is a positive thing in the world. And then it turns out Krishna is a great place of flute. And yet he plays this enchanting music, and we don't hear about other forms of Godhead or other forms of divinity or deity doing that, or Krishna's loving affairs. And so on. And actually, Rupa Goswami, in terms of practical psychology, is right. If you look at the history of India, what you find is that Krishna is the big winner. I mean, Krishna Leela, dancing with the gopis, and all the other amazing things that Krishna does, they are the most popular stories. They are more enchanting. There is more art and more literature and more poetry dedicated to that. So if you look at the different forms of God, so it's not only theoretical, because some things are proved not theoretically but historically. Sometimes you just have to look at history and see how human beings actually behave, as opposed to saying something theoretically. So I would say it's to some extent a historical argument. And also, it's another interesting, important point about Rupa Goswami's argument is that it's not in one sense anthropocentric. Anthropocentric means seeing human beings as the center. Anthropos is a Greek word for human beings. So, like anthropology. So, in this sense, children, if you study child psychology, children tend to see their parents as existing expressly to provide services to the child. Like, you're supposed to love me, you're supposed to feed me, take care of me, buy me sports equipment or dolls or whatever. So, or sports equipment for my dolls. So, but still, the idea is that in a sort of child psychology, the children conceive of the parents as existing for the sake of the children. In the same way, people who are in this sort of childish state of mind and who see God as existing for the sake of the worshiper actually don't like the idea of God having his own life. They want God to always be, so to speak, in character, like just be up there on the altar, just be the God of religion, just listen to our prayers and give blessings and just be always kind of very serious and majestic, and you know, that's your job description, to be the God of religion. Whereas in Krishna consciousness, there's a much higher conception that God actually has his own life. And as children get older, they begin to realize that their parents actually have their own life, their own friends, their own whatever. So again, people that say, well, how could Krishna dance, how could God dance with girls, how could he do all this stuff he does, they're in this childish conception. They just want God to always be in character as the God of religion. And it somehow makes them feel insecure or uncomfortable, the idea that God has his own life. But if you accept that God has his own life, then like, what's the greatest enjoyment, the greatest happiness? Then you begin to see the opulence of Krishna. Did that address your points? Yes? Mike, please.
It seems in any religion throughout history, the men who are in charge formulate whatever the philosophy is, that may be one thing, but how it is interpreted is usually formulated by a group of people who are the leaders, so-called leaders of the religion. So, and if they are fallible, then there will be fallible results as far as how the philosophy is presented. So my proposition is that it's essential to have a parampara of pure devotees who present this, otherwise whatever philosophy or religion it is won't have any validity.
Well, won't have any validity. What about a group of people?
Some validity.
Yeah.
Partial.
Yeah, we do have parampara, and Prabhupada, fortunately in our parampara, encouraged us to use our brains. So we do that within boundaries, though. In other words, Prabhupada gave us certain theological boundaries within that. He asks us to be intelligent. As Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Mayi buddhi niveshya, invest your intelligence in me. Krishna doesn't say to turn off your intelligence, but to invest it in me, dedicate your intelligence to me.
So how do you differentiate between intelligence and mental speculation?
Well, Prabhupada gave an example. He gave me an example. Krishna says, Rasoham apsu konte, I'm the taste in water. So if you speculate whether Krishna is the taste in water, that's mental speculation. This is Prabhupada's jargon. If you speculate how Krishna is the taste in water, that's philosophical speculation. So we accept certain basic things to be true about God and the soul, and then we try to understand how they're true. Yes, the last point, and then God.
I find actually many questions, but I'll just address to the Rupa Goswami. Because I find Saptarupa is actually spoken by Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, just like the one you just said, Rasoham apsu konte, that perception itself is Satogun. Perception of these things. So Krishna is saying that that's me.
Well, Krishna doesn't say that in the Gita. That Satogun is, he says that from Satogun comes knowledge.
But that's one aspect of Maya, that
yes, but Krishna is
still from him. That's
him. Yeah, we know that. But someone in Satvagun may not fully understand Krishna.
Oh,
we know that Krishna is behind everything.
My question on this Rupa Goswami, not question, just a little, I think he's a very nice person. That in Mahaprabhu's life, if we research, we find the Srila Rupa Goswami, when he came to this fourth quality special, it is not just a jugglery word or something. It has a very proven formula, as you explained very nicely. Just like when Mahaprabhu met Saivaya, Mahaprabhu did not argue or give a big philosophy. He just simply says, look at Lord Shiva. The Ganges water coming from Lord Vishnu's lotus feet. Here Lord Shiva is keeping on his head. So you decide. Now, in our jiva's living entities, eternal function, the thinking, willing, feeling, this, if we go even in that direction, or even, you know, one commentary in the 14th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, I find, sorry, Bhagavad Gita, 15th chapter, where you mentioned that when Parikshit Maharaj asked that question, the Brajagopis' love for Krishna is more higher than their own child. And in the commentary, you also put that self-preservation, self-centeredness is the first thing of loving yourself. So any angle if we go, even I studied Karl Marx, who is the founder of modern atheism or communism, Karl Marx. He himself proved that he was very much fascinated as soon as he met his girlfriend. When he was depressed, he could not write his theory of communism, all these things. And he always felt that feeling was coming more stronger than his belief of non-existence of God. So with this thinking, willing, feeling also, so when Rupa Goswami explained that with Narayan's story of Mahaprabhu's meeting with Banquet Bhatta, Lakshmi lives even though she is always eternal.
Yeah, but again, these things are true within certain contexts. In other words, if you don't accept the reality of Lakshmi Narayan, then that argument won't have force for you. So I contextualize his argument. He's arguing within a particular context for a certain community of people who accept certain things to be true.
But it can be proven any moment, any time.
Well, when you say it can be proved true, but proved to someone. In other words, it's impossible to prove to me the advanced principles of physics because I'm not a physicist, and therefore you may prove it but not to me because I can't evaluate the proof. So we have to distinguish between proving in general to qualified observers. In other words, we can say that, let's say in the field of physics or any other scientific field, scientists put forward proofs. And those proofs are addressed to a very limited community of fellow scientists who presumably can evaluate their arguments. And so in that way, Rupa Goswami is proving things to a certain group of people who have certain qualifications. It's not a general proof to everyone, because everyone is not qualified to evaluate the proof. So when we use the word prove, we have to have some sense of context. Yes, God, E.
I thought this might make a little comment about the idea of thought crimes, but the extreme torture and everything. The antithesis of that would be the kindness of Krishna, as he allows even thoughts of devotional service and activities, just thinking about those activities, to be counted as devotional service in this age. So, and also there's another point about having thoughts about devotees which are not favorable for devotional service. In other words, always seeing devotees in a positive way. So there are several things in mind that need to be considered in
But on the other hand, Rupa Goswami says in the Upadeshamrita, Krishneti Jasya Giritam, that if someone chants Hare Krishna but is not behaving properly, we should in our mind honor them but not associate with them. And so we are required to make distinctions. We are required to discriminate. Otherwise, you couldn't follow that instruction of Rupa Goswami. Becoming envious of a devotee or wishing them ill or just hating them, or that is not good. It pollutes the mind. But again, it's quid pro quo. It's like you get what you deserve. If you commit a mental crime, then you will mentally suffer. And if you speak something, then it's even worse. If you physically act, it's worse. So, but everything is proportional, and it's not eternal, and it's, I mean, certainly mental activities are part of our human makeup, but the response to our mental activities should be proportionate and reasonable. So we'll end here. Thank you all very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.